Adolescent psychiatrist and parent Meredith Gansner's new book is Teen Depression Gone Viral, Why Kids Are More Vulnerable Than Ever, and How You Can Protect Your Child's Health and Happiness. It's a guide that provides the latest information about depression in teens with a special focus on digital media use. What are the warning signs of depression in teens? When do social media and gaming habits cross the line? Just some of the questions addressed in the new book. It's a great pleasure to welcome Meredith Gansner to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
A great pleasure. What brought you to want to look at this, especially teen depression, but in this sense of with such a focus on the digital world?
Yeah, so one of the cool things about being in a research field that is new on the whole is that you get to see it evolve over time since the very beginning. And since, over a decade when I started becoming interested in this topic, I have seen researchers sort of bat back and forth again and again. You know, is social media causing all of the problems for teens in this world? Is it making them depressed? Do we know that it's making them depressed? Is it making them anxious? Is it making them suicidal? And I absolutely think that those studies are worth doing and really important for us to, you know, keep funding and keep understanding those complicated relationships. But as a clinician, I still see parents just struggling again and again with the question of, you know, what do I do? I have a child who is extremely depressed, and they're, you know, looking at information online related to suicide, or they are on their phones all the time. I can't get them out of their room or off their laptop. And unfortunately, we really haven't, as a field, made a lot of headway in providing concrete information to help parents with basically what to do in these situations. And so, especially after COVID, where I saw so many parents struggling to try to take care of their kids and make sure that their kids were attending classes when the classes were online and hold down their jobs, I realized that we needed to do better as a field in providing this sort of information to parents and helping them through this really difficult time.
Were we, I mean, obviously, I don't think any of us were ready for COVID or what it brought with us.
No.
And probably don't even know right now what, you know, all of the impacts are as a result of that tumultuous time. But obviously, teen issues and teen depression has been around for a long time. So where at the baseline are the similarities and where does it start to verge in the information that you're looking at?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. Depression has been around for ages, and even media-related concerns and the concern about how they impact mental health, I mean, that's a centuries-old question. I mean, even as back as television, right, we were saying, oh, is television rotting children's brains? And I think so. Digital media and social media are a bit different in the sense that, you know, no, they might not be more toxic than television. There are certainly concerns, but it just evolves a lot faster. And so we're having a difficult time trying to, as scientists and clinicians, kind of keep ahead of things. So we know what teens are most at risk for. We know that there are teens that may do certain things online that, you know, are risky or dangerous, or seek out certain types of games or certain types of platforms. We don't really even know who those at-risk teenagers are. And so right now, we're unfortunately, as clinicians, we're just kind of throwing things at the wall and hoping that something sticks. And that's not really a great way to practice medicine. So my hope is that in trying to draw attention to the fact that we don't have a lot of fantastic, concrete, evidence-based research in this area, we can find out who those high-risk teenagers are. I mean, most often they are children who have psychiatric illness, and then we can better help them manage their own problematic digital media use before significant adverse consequences result. So I think it's less that it's a, you know, brand new problem, although there are unique aspects of social media platforms for sure. Just the fact that you have access to, you know, internationally so many different people and so much unlimited information, you know, at your fingertips. But I think it's also just that it's moving so quickly.
So before we get into the nuts and bolts of what you were just talking about, let me ask the more diagnostic question of why aren't we better prepared? Why do we not have the data? Why do we not
look. I mean, we certainly have enough numbers, sadly mm-hmm. enough casualties, that there's information there. So it seems as though we aren't taking it seriously enough, and I'm interested into what guides that.
Yeah, I think, you know, unanimously people recognize that it's a problem. I think there are two unique factors that have made it particularly hard to research. One being that it's a very complex entity, right? Social media platforms. And unless we are able to put a group of teens in one room and have them closed off from the outside world and not have them use any social media at all, and then we have like another room where there's a group of teens that are also closed off and have access to only certain types of social media, it's the exact same social media platforms, we really can't do kind of a gold standard study, like a randomized control trial in this area. That's not something that is really possible in terms of the ethics of research and even getting a teenager to assent to that, right? To just not use social media for a period of time. So it's just tricky to study because teens already are drawn to those platforms as a way to connect with the outside world. They have to go on devices for their homework. And so researchers are just limited from that aspect. And the other piece is,
No, go ahead. Please go ahead.
Okay. And the other piece is that science as a whole and research is also trying to catch up with how we can have these studies occur in a way that is ethical, in a way that is protecting the safety of our subjects. And because the technology is so new, there are a lot of barriers to studying some of these questions in teens, right? We know that social media platforms, for example, and I guess most any sort of digital media platform, they're collecting data constantly on teens, right? Especially because teenagers, they amount to tons of advertising revenue. So we know they have tons of data on these teens, and they know what they're looking at, and they know what they're interested in. And researchers can't get access to that data because the social media platforms companies aren't going to give us that data. But we also have a lot of difficulty trying to use our own research technologies to capture that data as well. And more often than not, but at least frequently, I have encountered that barrier when you propose certain studies, looking at what kids are doing online, there can be a lot of concern about what we're finding, how we're going to monitor that. If we see a child looking at something concerning and that comes up in the course of the study, under what obligation do we report that immediately? You know, what if we see that at 3 a.m, who is monitoring the data? So there are a lot of really important ethical questions that have blocked our ability to move as quickly as we need to in the research field, especially government-funded research in this area.
You spend the first part of the book talking about episodes of depression and how they develop, which is mm-hmm. fascinating. That's followed up by a whole section that I would like to focus on just for a moment, and that is mm-hmm. the treatment landscape. Talk about, in general terms, what that landscape is, and then perhaps a bit more specifically, where it is lacking, and just in sheer number, right? That just having enough trained individuals to help those who are in need.
Yeah. So the treatment landscape right now sort of looks at treating depression in three kind of buckets. So first and foremost, you have kind of lifestyle related factors. And oftentimes for kids who have mild to moderate symptoms, we really want to avoid medications or intensive treatment if we think we can avoid it. And so that's thinking about things like optimizing sleep. There's a lot of great evidence that kids who are not sleeping well definitely have a hit to their mood. I think most of us can subjectively experience that or protest to that. And also things like getting enough sunlight, getting exercise, particularly moderate exercise, eating a healthy diet that's well-balanced, certainly just eating at all, because oftentimes children with depression may have a decrease in their appetite. So those are all important things that we think about in terms of targeting factors that we may not have absolute proof that they cause alone depression, but that if they're all together sort of askew and not optimized could potentially contribute to an episode of depression, right? And then when kids are experiencing, you know, more significant symptoms, we will oftentimes recommend therapy. And for kids with depression, we oftentimes recommend cognitive behavioral therapy as a good place to start. There's also IPT, interpersonal therapy as well. which have been shown to be helpful in children challenging some of the thoughts that they have about how they relate to others and how depression is impacting them. Some of those kind of internal feelings of, you know, I'm not good enough, nobody likes me. And then trying to actively challenge this part of them that just sort of wants to stay shut off from the outside world or not engage with others, not eat, poor sleep, things like that. And then when children are having more significant symptoms to the point where they might be having thoughts of not wanting to be alive anymore, at that point, we would very strongly suggest adding medication. And for children, most commonly, that would be a medication called an SSRI, which many people, I think, now have been maybe more aware of than before, given that the current head of HHS has wanted it to be a priority to look at SSRI prescriptions in children and to treat depression. But that is currently the medications we have the most evidence for in terms of treating adolescent depression. They do appear to be effective, but we also really want to be very transparent to parents that we can't treat depression with just one of these things alone, right? It's just, it's like you're trying to essentially make a stool with one leg. You, in order for things to function, you have to have kind of all three parts to be optimized so that, you know, ideally someone's in therapy and is on medication and is trying to optimize their sleep and their eating and other lifestyle related changes when they're suffering from significant symptoms. But that can be really tricky to do because I'm telling parents to do this well knowing that it is really challenging sometimes to even find a therapist these days for kids. There can be wait lists that are months long. And if you do find a therapist, maybe that therapist isn't someone that your child really relates to, or that you can't even get them the house to get out of the house to get to therapy, right? And then with medications too, not every medication that a child tries is going to be helpful. And unfortunately in psychiatry, we still don't have a good sense of which medication will be most helpful for which child. And so there's trial and error in that too. And so I think one of the greatest disservices we do as a field is appearing maybe overconfident of the treatments that we offer, saying this will absolutely fix the problem, because that just isn't the case. And when parents try something and they believe in us and they just like, okay, we just do medication, we just do therapy, that will fix the problem, and then it doesn't work, then I think that creates more harm and just parents feeling demoralized and the child feeling demoralized and maybe disengaging from treatment entirely.
There are many resources, of course. There is a suicide and crisis lifeline where you can call or text if any of the information that we're discussing is hitting home for you and you need more information, and that's 988-988, and one of just many, many resources that is out there. I'm curious, as an attending child psychiatrist at Boston Children's Hospital, you're an instructor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. If you got your colleagues together and you were sitting around a table, what's the wish list? What would you hope for?
What would I hope for in terms of helping improve mental health
Correct.
For kids?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, man, that would be a long list.
To make your day-to-day job easier and effective and more effective than it can be. In other words, there are the kids who obviously you're reaching and it's working, but then there are those who are not. And in mm-hmm. what your thoughts are as what can help improve that.
So I think my biggest wish would actually be to try to figure out as a society better ways that we can tackle some of the known risk factors for depression in teens. So to try and get at the problem before it even starts. So really just having far better social services for children than currently exist, right? I mean, we, I think as a field of medicine, tend to be overly eager to get to problems only when they've become bad. I think in general, especially in the United States, medicine doesn't do a great job with preventative medicine and really trying to spread knowledge about preventative health more than we have been. But also that's partly because it doesn't seem to be prioritized. And some states do better than others. But right, making sure that parents have access to resources so that there's food on the table, that individuals who are struggling at home, if parents have their own mental health issues or substance use issues, that they themselves have access to treatment, because that will certainly impact the youth mental health. Also making sure that we have, you know, school environments that are supportive for children, that can provide educational supports when they're needed. So for children who may have learning disorders, learning disabilities, that they're able to access all the school classes and understand them in a way that will help prevent them from feeling like they're falling behind their peers. I think all of those important societal, supports in that infrastructure is sometimes taken for granted. But oftentimes, you know, some people just don't have access to it at all. And so if you have means and you have the time, right? Time is the huge mean, then you can potentially get access to some of those things, and you know how to advocate for your child. But so many parents are just so strapped for time as is, and they might barely be able to hold on to their job. So they need to be in a society where they're just, you know, better support, where it's easier for them to get access to things to help their family, to help their mental health, and to help their children. So that would actually be my biggest wish, because I think that would, you know, ideally prevent us from having this situation where tons of children might be getting more depressed, and then we have to figure out how to treat that all at once. And, you know, in terms of trying to better treat children, then it's really improving the mental health system as well, making sure that there is access everywhere to therapists, that we are trying to do our best to make sure that families aren't having to pay out of pocket for therapists and for medication if it's needed, and making sure that that is equitable, such that everybody has access. And again, it's not only the people who are, you know, have means that are able to access all those things. The mental health system, I think, I hope it comes across in my book, it's very clear it is lacking. It is really lacking. And that's, you know, not because of the people who are in the field, who are all amazing and work incredibly hard. But we recognize that we're oftentimes, when we see a patient and when they're suffering, we are coming into it kind of at the end of an episode, right? Or maybe the peak of an episode. We would love to be able to get to that child before the symptoms are so significant that they're needing to come into the hospital or they're needing to go on medication. And we're just not there yet in terms of being able to identify those kids and offer them those supports before it becomes a situation where they need to have that specialized care.
The name of the book is Teen Depression Gone Viral, Why Kids Are More Vulnerable Than Ever, and How You Can Protect Your Child's Health and Happiness. The book is published by the Guilford Press. Dr. Gansner, I thank you very much for spending time with us and for talking about these important issues. And I so appreciate your time, and I wish you the best of luck in this world.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Teen Depression Gone Viral. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.